talking about refuge. And the prayers that we did this morning directly relate to refuge, to entrusting our spiritual guidance to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Because when we entrust our spiritual guidance to the three jewels, we should know what in the world the three jewels are. Okay, Buddhism is not a faith of, you know, blind faith, like somebody said, believe in the three jewels, and you go, yeah, that sounds good to me. But we have to really understand what they are and what refuge is, why we rely on them, and how to rely on them. So the prayers we started out this morning is saying the Prajnaparamita, perfection of wisdom, mantra, tayata gati gati paragati parasangati bodhisoha. And when we said that, it reminded me that, you know, all, the whole refuge is possible because emptiness exists. Now, that without everything having the nature of being empty and inherent existence, then there's no possible way for the three jewels to exist and no refuge exists. Okay. Why is this? Because the actual thing that we take refuge in, the actual refuge is the Dharma. Okay? That the Dharma doesn't just mean the scriptures and the words and the texts, you know, but the real Dharma refers to the last two noble truths, true cessations and true paths. Okay? First two noble truths, true suffering and true origin of suffering. Okay, so the last two, true cessation and true path. Those two are the Dharma refuge. That's what we're taking refuge in. And that's what ultimately protects our mind. So what are these two? Okay. Let's start with true path. True path refers to the wisdom consciousnesses that realize emptiness, and specifically that realize emptiness directly, non-conceptually. So those wisdom consciousnesses are what purifies our mind from the stains of ignorance. Okay? So the basic nature of our mind is something pure. It's open like the sky. The ignorance, and we've been talking about ignorance the last two nights. Okay, this ignorance, you know, is like clouds that obscures the nature of our sky. The ignorance is not the nature of those clouds are not the nature of the sky, and likewise ignorance is not the nature of our mind, nor are the other defilements the nature of our mind. So they can be removed. So to remove them, we have to realize the emptiness, generate this wisdom consciousness that realizes the emptiness of how things exist. Because ignorance, okay, projects a way of existing onto phenomena that they don't have. Okay, so the object that ignorance grasps at actually doesn't exist, but we think it does. Ignorance is a mistaken consciousness because specifically we see everything very, very solid, don't we? Okay, everything solid. It starts out with me. There's a real me. And we've been talking about this real me and all its shenanigans the last two nights. Okay. So it starts out, there's this real me, and then there's real happiness, and there's real suffering, and a real me means real happiness, so there's real attachment to this happiness. And there's real anger, solid anger, you know, that's justified, that's right, you know, that we have towards what interferes with our happiness. Okay, so we see ourselves as kind of solid, existing from our own side. We see the sources of happiness and suffering as solid, objectively existing out there. We see our feelings of happiness and misery and indifference as solid feelings. Okay, we see everything as very solid. So then we are fighting against everything all the time because you just have all these solid bricks that keep bumping into each other, okay? So ignorance perceives everything as existing, having this own having its own objective nature out there. Okay? So, for example, when you look at a person, I mean, look around the room, you look at all these people, it looks like there's real people there, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay? There's real people. I mean, there's a real Steve. Yeah? Because this real Steve is running the real tape recorder, you know? And the real microphone, which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, you know? But, you know, we look out and there's a real him and there's a real Anne and there's a real children and, you know, there's whoever your names are, there's real yous, okay? But if we start to ask who are these people really, you know, if there were real people out there, you know, then we should be able to find them. Yeah, if there's a real concrete person, you know, or some kind of soul or self, something that is you, then we should be able to find it. Okay, because that's what we perceive. Okay, that's what ignorance grasps at. But when you start looking for yourself, you know, what can you draw a line around and say, that's who I am? Are any of your achievements you? You know, you have your diplomas, you have your trophies, you have your little badges and awards. Are those you? No. They're metal and steel and paper. They're not a human being. Okay. What about your body? Is your body you? We always say, I. Okay. Is our body me? If you cut open your body, do you find me? Is there one part of your body that's you? You know? And now in the days of science, we feel our brain is me. You know, my brain is me. So if that were so, if the brain were the person, then you could put a brain out there on the table and you would say, hi, Sam, because the brain's the person. Okay? Is the brain the person? No, the brain is just some physical material that's changing all the time, isn't it? You know, new cells and new electrons and, yeah. So the brain isn't us. I mean, you don't look at a brain and see a person, do you? Do you look at any other part of your body? If you put your heart out on the table. Hi, Susan. We don't do that, do we? Okay? So if we start looking through our body to find one part of our body that we can designate as us, we can't find anything. Okay? There's just all these physical parts. And if we break it down even smaller, there's just molecules. And even smaller, there's atoms. And then there's all these subatomic particles that they discover new ones each year, so I can't even remember what they're called. Okay? But none of that is a person. Okay. So then we go, oh, okay, my body's not me, but my mind is me. You know, remember Descartes, I think, therefore I am? Okay. So are your consciousnesses you? The consciousness that sees, is that you? Consciousness that hears, is that you? We say, no, it's my mental consciousness, the one that thinks. Or if you're the emotional type, it's my mental consciousness, the one that emotes. Okay, that's me. Well, in that case, if that were you, which thought are you? And which emotion are you? Because if we look, it's not like there's one mental consciousness that just has one thought all the time where we can find a real I. There's all these different thoughts that change real fast. So which one, which of those mental consciousnesses is me? Or which emotion is me? Am I my anger? Am I my love? No. If I were any of those emotions, I should have that emotion all the time because I always have a sense of I. But we don't have any emotion all the time, do we? Okay. Is there any kind of I, soul, me, that's separate from your body and mind? You know, like in that movie, what was it? I forget the name of it. Was it Ghost or something, you know, where somebody dies and then you float up out of the body and you go kerplunk into another body. Is there some kind of soul like that, you know, that's separate from your body and mind? In which case, body and mind could be here and I could be across the room. Right? So my body and mind is here and children's talking over there. Doesn't make sense, does it? Okay. We can't find an I that's separate from our body and mind, and yet we can't find an I or a self that is our body and mind. Okay. So the view of ignorance that thinks that there's a real I, a real self in there, it's grasping at something that doesn't exist, because the solid self upon which we construct our whole life, mind you. Okay. Don't you think? Isn't your whole life constructed around this sense of a solid self, a real me? Okay. So this whole me that everything's constructed around doesn't exist at all. And yet ignorance thinks it does. So, I mean, no wonder we have problems. Yeah. And that's why we have to generate the wisdom that understands that that thing, the object that ignorance is grasping at, doesn't exist. That there's no solid soul or self or inherent me or anything like that. Okay? So that wisdom is what counteracts the ignorance. Since the attachment and the anger are built upon the ignorance, when you counteract the ignorance, then the attachment and the anger and the jealousy and the arrogance all fall apart too. Okay? So, based on the fact that everything, the deeper nature, the ultimate nature of everything is empty of any kind of inherent, existent, solid anything, its own nature. Because of that, therefore, it's possible to generate the wisdom that realizes that empty nature. That wisdom that realizes the empty nature is the true path. Okay? The fourth noble truth. When we purify our mind stream of all the ignorance, anger, and attachment, the purification of the mind stream, okay, the removal, the cessation of the defilements, that those become the true cessations, which are the third noble truth. So this is a little bit technical information, but if we're going to say that we're Buddhist, we better know something about it, otherwise we just become... Somebody says, well, why are you a Buddhist, and what are the three jewels? And we go, three jewels? Pearls, rubies. Okay. It's not like that. I mean, we have to know what it is that we're taking refuge in and know why we take refuge in that, what it's all about. Okay? So it's a little bit technical, but it's important to understand, especially because we're talking about how to cease our suffering. Okay? I mean, the true paths are what we have to actualize to cease our suffering. And the cessations, the true cessations, are those cessations of sufferings and the cessations of all the defiled mental states that cause them. Okay? So, that's the Dharma refuge. Okay? So the Dharma refuge is all built upon the fact that things are empty of inherent existence. Yeah? Then, from the Dharma refuge, we get people who understand the Dharma refuge, people who realize the Dharma refuge, directly, who generate the true paths in their mind and gain the true cessations. Those are the Sangha refuge. Okay, that's the Sangha we take refuge in. And then the Buddha we take refuge in is the one that has fully realized emptiness directly and removed, has the ultimate true cessation of all the sufferings, all the stains, all the defilements. Okay? So that's how we get the three refuges. You know, that's what we're taking refuge in. So when we say, Nama Guruvya, Nama Buddhaya, Nama Dharmaya, Nama Sanghaya, this is what we should be thinking about. You know? And it's very important, especially with the Sangha refuge, because people can be really confused about that. The Sangha we take refuge in refers to any person, lay or monastic, who has the direct perception of emptiness. Okay? The way the word Sangha is used in India and in the Tibet, among the Tibetans, Sangha refers to a group of four or more fully ordained monastics. Okay? In the West, Sangha tends to be used for anybody who comes to a Buddhist center. which I think is a little bit too loose of a usage of the word Sangha, because then we can get very confused, because we come to the center and we hear, I take refuge in the Sangha, and we look around and, you know, there's, you know, Joe, who's been at 2 Dharma teachings and is still smoking dope and, you know, cheating on his income tax, and I take refuge in him? Come on, you know. So it can get a little bit confusing to us if we use Sangha in that way. Okay, if we think of Sangha as you know, in that way is what we take refuge in. Okay, so we're taking refuge in those beings who have the actual direct non-conceptual realization of emptiness, and therefore who have started to cease the defilements on their mind stream. Okay. We need to be clear about that. And similarly, you know, when we take refuge in the Dharma, we're not taking refuge in a text. A text is worth through text. You have a text on that side, yeah? So, you know, that the text expresses the meaning of the Dharma. Okay? But the text itself can't save us from suffering. Especially because it's in Tibetan and we don't understand it. You know? So, but we respect the text because they explain the meaning of the Dharma, but it's the real meaning of the Dharma that we have to actualize in our own heart, because that's what actually liberates us. Okay? So we get the three jewels there. Now, what's really tricky in the Tibetan tradition is we start off our refuge, Namo Guru Vya. I take refuge in the Guru. So other Buddhist traditions look at us and say, hey, I thought there's three jewels of refuge. Why, you added a fourth one. What's the story? And we have to explain, no, the Guru is not a fourth object of refuge. The Guru is the embodiment of all three objects of refuge. It's not a separate object. And then somebody says, well, what in the world is the Guru? You know, here's your Guru, who's some human being, you know, and they have a personality, and they eat and they poop like everybody else, and you take refuge in another human being, you know? And we can get a little stuck there, can't we? Yeah. And especially because when you start to get into Tantra and you hear all this stuff about relying on your spiritual master, which is mistranslated as guru devotion, that's not a correct translation. But it's Lama Tenpa means relying or depending on a spiritual mentor. We get very confused because we think spiritual mentor means that person. Okay? There's, you know, your teacher, you know, Gelug Rinpoche or Dalai Lama, whoever it is, and you think that person with their personality is the guru. And then when your guru passes away, you go into crisis because your object of refuge is no longer there. And I've seen this, I mean, because my teachers passed away, and then all of a sudden some of the disciples were totally lost. It's like, you know, because they were totally relying on the personality and the physical presence of the guru, thinking that the guru they take refuge in is that, you know, human manifestation, that body and that personality. Okay. And then we also get very screwed up when we think that the guru is the personality, because sometimes our teacher's in a good mood and sometimes they're not in a good mood. You know? And so, of course, if we take refuge, we want to take refuge in a guru who's in a good mood. You know? Who pats us on the back and tells us what great students we are and how wonderful we are and, you know, everything like this. But sometimes our guru doesn't treat us that way, does he? You know, sometimes our guru looks at us and says, you know, you lazy bum, you know, get onto your cushion and do some practice. And we go, oh, I'm trying. You know, please be nice to me. And so we get all mixed up. You know, I take refuge in him. Well, this is guru I'm taking refuge in. Okay. If I take refuge in him, he should be always nice to me. Okay. So when we say Namo Guru Vya, okay, the real guru, okay, that we take refuge in is the wisdom of bliss and emptiness. Okay. That's the, when we say Namo Guru Vya, what were you taking refuge in is that wisdom of bliss and emptiness. Okay, inseparable, indivisible bliss and emptiness. That is the ultimate guru. Okay, we say that that wisdom manifests in the forms of different Buddhists, in the forms of different deities, in the forms of our various teachers. Okay, but those forms are more conventional things. Yeah, the real thing we're taking refuge in is coming back to the Dharma refuge, isn't it? Because that wisdom of bliss and emptiness is the true cessation and the true path. Okay? So it's coming back to that. That's what we're really taking refuge in. And so if we see the deities as a manifestation of that, and the Buddha and the Sangha as a manifestation of that, and the physical teacher who teaches us as a manifestation of that, you know, then we have a more correct understanding, because then even if our physical teacher passes away, you know, we still have refuge in the guru, because we see that that physical thing was just a bubble, you know, that appeared according to our karma. You know, out of the wisdom of bliss and emptiness, this kind of, according to the karma that we have, yeah, that wisdom manifests in a way that's suitable to guide us. So it's like a bubble that's coming out of, you know, due to our karma, coming out of the wisdom of bliss and emptiness. So when that bubble is no longer there, the wisdom of bliss and emptiness is still there. And that's what our refuge is. And that's what we, you know, rely on. So it's very, very important to understand that in Tibetan Buddhism. Otherwise, we can get really, really mixed up. Okay. Any of you mixed up? I was mixed up for a long time about this whole thing. Yeah? So, and I meet a lot of people who are mixed up. Maybe you're not any of them, but... Okay, but it really was something that was very confusing to me. Okay, when we... Let's go back to the prayers we do at the beginning. We started out with the Prajnaparamita mantra. You know, Tayata Gati Gati Paragati Parasangati Bodhisoha. That mantra is expressing the different levels of realization of emptiness. Okay? So that mantra is expressing the Dharma refuge. So it starts out tayata. Tayata means it is like this. Okay? Gati means go. Okay? So it's like our teachers go, go, go beyond, go completely beyond enlightenment, you know, go for it. Okay, so it's exhorting us to do something. Okay, so we have gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhi. Okay, we have five things there, right? So those correspond to, on the Mahayana path, the five Mahayana paths. Okay? Have you studied these at all? Okay? Okay, yeah. So it's talking about these five paths, okay? So the first gati is path of accumulation, second one, path of preparation, third one, path of seeing, fourth, path of meditation, and fifth, path of no more learning. Yeah. When we understand these five paths, we understand how it's possible to gradually develop our mind so it becomes the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay? And it's also a little bit humbling when we understand the path, because we like to think of ourselves as people on the path. But when we hear the definition of the first path, I'm not even on the first path. Okay, so, you know, thinking of myself on the path is, you know, giving the name of the result to the cause, okay, because I'm not there. Okay, but on the Mahayana path, the boundary line, the line of demarcation for entering the Mahayana path, okay, is when we have spontaneous bodhicitta. Okay. Spontaneous bodhicitta is predicated on spontaneous renunciation. How many of us have renunciation? I mean, if we're really honest, do we really have renunciation? Samsara looks pretty good to us, doesn't it? You know? I mean, we want to tweak samsara here and tweak it there and make it a little bit better. But who wants to get out of it? You know, when you can have good food and a good sex life and be popular and, you know, have people praise you, who wants to get rid of all that? Let's just tweak it and make it better. Okay, so, I mean, we're very far from renunciation, actually. Well, at least I am. I can't speak for you. Yeah. So, renunciation is the determination to be free. And lots of people in Buddhism, or people come to Buddhism, says, oh, Buddhism talks so much about compassion for others. What about compassion for us, for ourselves? That's what renunciation is. Renunciation is having compassion for ourselves. It's wanting ourselves to be free of all the suffering of samsara. Okay. So we don't, from a Buddhist sense, even have compassion for ourselves. Because we're wanting ourselves to have all samsaric pleasures. Isn't that? You know, isn't our motivation first thing in the morning, may I have every single samsaric pleasure possible? Isn't that our gut feeling? Our gut feeling, what's really going on? Isn't it that? You know? I mean, do we wake up in the morning and really think, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes? No. We think, may I have happiness? Not even the happiness of enlightenment. I don't even wish that for myself. But may I have delicious food? May I meet Prince Charming? May I get the promotion? May I lie on the beach? May I, you know, have every possible sense pleasure that there is. You know, nice clothes, nice jewelry. You know, I don't want to grow old. I don't want to get sick. I don't want to watch the war. May I have every possible sense pleasure and no suffering. That's our thought. Okay. So we don't really have actually compassion for ourselves, wanting ourselves to be free of all of that kind of suffering. Because that's all suffering. That's what, you know, in the three kinds of suffering, remember those? Yeah, suffering of pain, suffering of change, and all-pervading suffering. That's the one that's suffering of change, that we, in our ignorance, think is happiness. Okay? So sometimes, I mean, if we really think about how our mind thinks, we really begin to get a feeling of what ignorance means, you know, and how totally a de la our mind is from any kind of reality. You know, because we think chocolate cake is happiness. Don't we? It is. Let's have it. Okay, cancel the teachings and let's go for the chocolate cake. Yeah, right. You noticed everybody woke up when I was talking about true path and true cessation. You're all sitting there like this. Yeah, when I talk about chocolate cake, everybody's awake. Okay. So, yeah, so, you know, we first have to have the compassion for ourselves that wants ourselves to be free of cyclic existence. Then we have to realize that everybody else feels exactly the same, is in the same predicament, and care about them as much as we care about ourselves, and want them to be free of suffering. And not only wanting them to be free of suffering, but we have to commit ourselves to do something about it. There's that C word. Yeah. The word we are terrified of in this country. Okay. And it's not cancer. It's commitment. And which are you more afraid of, cancer or commitment? Think about it. We run our lives. We don't like to commit, do we? We don't want to commit. We want all of our options open. So we can do anything we want when we feel like it, so it's all comfortable for us. But we don't want to commit to things, okay? Even in our spiritual path, we want to go around and taste all the different flavors, you know, instead of commit to one thing and really go into it, Okay. In our relationships, we want to go around and have a good time instead of really build long-term friendships and stick with people through ups and downs and resolve our difficulties with them. Okay. In our jobs, we're only with a company as long as it's convenient for us. We don't really commit to our employers and have a feeling of team spirit. Okay? So even in the Dharma Center, you know, I mean, it's hard to get people to commit even to come and, you know, open the center sometimes, isn't it? Because I'll commit that, you know, today I'm busy. Yeah, can somebody else do it? I have to go cut tulips today. So, you know, somebody else please set up the center for the teaching. You know, it's very difficult for us to commit because we fear commitment. We think commitment is an impingement on our freedom. And we think freedom means, you know, in our ignorance, we think freedom means we can do anything we want when we want to do it. Okay? I mean, that was the champion of my generation, you know, if it feels good, do it. Yeah, don't commit to anything. And did it bring happiness? Okay, no, we're still in the same stupid boat, aren't we? You know, it doesn't bring happiness. We go around, we keep all of our options open, we don't commit to anything, we have a good time. And what do we have to show for the end of it? You know, a scrapbook full of photographs, you know. Or a computer full of digital ones. No. But what's that? You know, that's not a life. Okay? So commitment is really important, but we really, you know, we get very frightened. So here's the bodhicitta. Okay? Which is the entryway to the first path. Okay? And it's the commitment, you know, to become a Buddha because we're committing ourselves to work for the benefit of others. Not even ourselves, you know. I mean, of course, it includes ourselves, but others are more numerous. I mean, that's a pretty big commitment, isn't it? Okay? And it's not just having that commitment when you're sitting in front of the Dalai Lama. It's having that commitment every time you see a sentient being. Okay? So it means every time you see a sentient being, your spontaneous reaction is, I want to become a Buddha in order to work for their welfare. And lead them to happiness and out of all samsaric suffering. That's pretty intense, isn't it? When we really think about what bodhicitta is. I mean, is that our spontaneous reaction when you turn on the TV and you see Donald Rumsfeld? Is that your spontaneous reaction? You know, I want to get enlightened as quick as possible to lead him to enlightenment. You know? Or when you see Saddam Hussein, is that your reaction? I must get enlightened quickly to lead him to enlightenment. You know? That's not our reaction, is it? Okay? But this is what entering the first path. Okay? This is what we have to enter the first path. It's that spontaneous bodhicitta. You know? So I don't know about you, but I have a ways to go. Yeah. But that's the gate. We arrive at the gate when we have that spontaneous bodhicitta. It's called the path of accumulation, that first path, because we are accumulating the merit or the positive potential in order to arrive at the second path. And the second path is a union of mental quiescence, meditative quiescence, and special insight. Okay, so what are mental, that's the second gate, okay, this union of mental quiescence, which is sometimes called calm abiding, and special insight, okay. So this, at the level of the path of preparation, the second path, this is a realization of emptiness, okay, that has the correct view, it realizes emptiness correctly, but it's not a direct realization of emptiness. You know, there's still the veil of a mental image. It's still conceptual. Okay? So it's a correct understanding of emptiness. Yeah. And we have the meditative quiescence that is able to stay on that understanding as long as we want. But it's not yet a direct perception of emptiness. But it's still pretty good, okay? So again, we look at ourselves. I mean, last night we were talking about what excellent concentration we have when it comes to planning our retaliation to somebody who hurt us. Okay, but do we have single-pointed concentration on the nature of reality, even if it's a conceptual understanding? No, we meditate on emptiness, and that's so boring. You know, I'd much rather think about my problems, because they're all about me. Yeah, or we think we have a realization of emptiness. You know, it's like we get 2 seconds of a quiet mind. Oh, I've realized emptiness. Yeah, that's not the realization of emptiness. My mind is empty. You know, we think emptiness means you don't have any thoughts. That's not what emptiness is. Okay, so we have to gain the correct view of emptiness, and then we have to be able to, you know, focus on it single-pointedly. When we can do that, based on the bodhicitta motivation, and we have enough merit, that's the demarcation line of the path of preparation, the second Mahayana path. So that's the second gate. Okay, gate, paragate. Okay, so gone beyond. The third, you know, one, the gone beyond, the paragate, is the path of seeing. And that's called gone beyond because it's at that time that our wisdom realizes emptiness directly without the veil of a mental image. Okay? So we still have this union of meditative quiescence and special insight. Okay? And it has the correct view and it knows it directly without any kind of mental image being in the way. And that is when we first start having the true path. Okay? So that's when we first get the true path and the true cessation, which are our Dharma refuge, is on the path of seeing. Okay? That wisdom becomes the true path. The level of defilements that are removed at the path of seeing, you know, the absence or cessation of them becomes the true cessation of the path of seeing. Okay? So gate, paragate, parasangate. Okay, gone completely beyond. That's the fourth path, the path of meditation. So once we've realized emptiness and realized it directly, it's not like all of our defilements go away. Okay? And this is a big mistake. You really see this in American Dharma communities. People think that they have some, like, insight of emptiness, and they think thereafter they're enlightened. Okay, and first of all, it's not even sure if they understood emptiness correctly. It's not even sure if they have meditative quiescence on it. But then the mistake is, you know, even if we get some glimpse of emptiness, we think, okay, gone. You know, all my anger's gone. And it's not like that, okay, because we have from beginningless time great familiarity with ignorance, anger, and attachment. They're not going to go away like that. Okay, it's like when you clean your house. You clean one layer of dirt, and then you have to clean another, and you have to clean another. So it's like that cleaning our mind. So we realize emptiness directly on path of seeing. Then we have to familiarize ourselves with it and clean all these different layers of defilement, you know, on our mind. That's what we do in the path of meditation, is we get rid of all the different layers of defilement. Okay? Because, for example, we have very gross anger, we have subtle anger, we have very subtle anger. Okay? We have attachment that we've learned in this life, we have innate attachment, we have very subtle innate attachment. You know, so there's all sorts of different levels of the defilement that we have to cleanse from our mental continuum. So that's what's done on the path of meditation. And remember that the word meditation in Buddhism is the same verbal root as to familiarize or to habituate. So this is reminding us, you know, that it's not just to get a glimpse of emptiness and it's gone, but we familiarize, habituate ourselves with that understanding of reality, and over time what that does is it removes all the defilements from the mind. Okay, so that's gate, gate, parasangate. Okay, now, bodhi. Okay, that's the enlightenment. Okay, and from a Mahayana perspective, that enlightenment that we're aiming for is not simply the elimination of all the afflictions, the disturbing attitudes and negative emotions and their seeds, because those are what cause samsara. But it's also the elimination of all the subtle stains on the mind, okay, the imprints, this Tibetan word bakchak, okay, these imprints or predispositions that cause everything to appear truly existent to us. Okay, so that appearance of true existence and the imprints that bring it about, those are the, you know, the obscurations to omniscience, and that's what we have to remove in order to arrive at the path of no more learning, which is full enlightenment. Okay. When we're enlightened, then we get the four Buddha bodies. Okay? Remember the four Buddha bodies? All those nice Sanskrit terms that you can't remember? Okay? But, you know, it's very helpful to understand this because it gives us an idea of where we're going on the path. Because otherwise, you know, kind of we come and we say over and over again, may I become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings, and then somebody comes along and says, what's a Buddha? And we say, that guy. You know? And then people say, oh, so you worship idols, don't you? Because you're all bowing down to a statue. We aren't worshiping idols. We don't want to become a statue. Okay? So the four Buddha bodies talk about the qualities of a fully enlightened being. Yeah? It's really neat, the four Buddha bodies, because they start out with two, and then you can divide it into three, and then you can divide into four. You can even divide it into five. So if you like numbers and categories, be a Buddhist. Okay. You got lots of numbers and categories. So if we talk about two Buddha bodies, started out, remember, Dharmakaya and Rupakaya? Okay. So the Dharmakaya is the Buddha's omniscient mind. Okay, that's the true path and true cessation. Here's the Dharma refuge again. Okay. The Rupakaya are the manifestations that a Buddha puts out there for the benefit of sentient beings. Now, why does a Buddha make many manifestations? Because we sentient beings are too obscured to know the Buddha's mind directly. I mean, can you sit there and close your mind and close your eyes and perceive the Buddha's mind directly? You know, do we have any understanding what a Buddha's mind is like? No. Okay. So the Buddha, out of compassion, appears in various forms in order to communicate with us. Okay, Buddha kind of comes down to our level, and we're very physically oriented, aren't we? So we can talk about the form body and the wisdom body, the Dharmakaya, the Rupakaya, or the truth body and the form body. The form body can be divided into two. So here's how we get three Buddha bodies. Okay, so there's one form body, the Sambhogakaya, that's the body of light that the Buddha manifests in the Pure Land, where he talks to all the bodhisattvas that are on the path of seeing and above. Okay, and then there's the form body that a Buddha manifests in our world, and here's where we get Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, His Holiness Dalai Lama, all of our various teachers who appear in these very gross bodies. You know, what appears to us to be very gross bodies anyway, in order to communicate with us. And so that's why we get this appearance of our teacher who's sometimes in a good mood and sometimes in a bad mood, because, Westerners, we're so funny, you know, we always come and we say, well, why doesn't the Buddha, why appears this teacher, kind of this person here? If Buddha has this omniscient mind, why doesn't he just, emanate and come down in a body of golden light? You know? Or why doesn't our guru show all of his, his or her clairvoyant powers? Because then we would really have faith. Okay? Lots of people say that. Don't you? I mean, don't you kind of wish your teacher would do, like, some kind of clairvoyant pizzazz? You know? So we could go, wow! You know, he's enlightened. Okay? But think about it. I mean, why don't our teachers do that? Yeah? Because we would, you know, precisely because of the fact that we would just sit there and go, wow, look. You know, there's fire coming out of his body and he's not burning up. Wow, he can levitate. You know, and we would just sit there and, you know, like teenagers, like groupies, you know, looking at rock stars, wouldn't we? And we wouldn't do any practice. We'd just sit there and gossip about our teachers. My teacher can levitate. Can your teacher? Well, no, my teacher's not an expert in levitation, but he can read your mind. Wow. How do you know he reads your mind? Because whenever I want chocolate, he gives me some. So of course the Buddha is not going to, you know, manifest. Our teachers are not going to manifest and show this kind of form. Because look at us. I mean, we're so dumb that we would just get stuck in some kind of teenage idol worship. Okay? So they really appear in a form that looks like us. And, I mean, His Holiness talks about this, and His Holiness especially, he talks about the Sangha refuge, those Arya Bodhisattvas, the ones who realize emptiness directly. And he says, you look at them, and they kind of look like you, but they're better than you. So you get this energy of, well, if they can do it, I can do it. Okay? So that's why the Buddha may appear in the form of our teacher, because, you know, teacher kind of has an ordinary body, you know, has ordinary problems like we do. But we